This is FM 100.5 and 101.9. AM 1450, Rutherford County's place to talk. WGNS, Murfreesboro, your good neighbor station. This is The Truman Show with Truman Jones. A look at the politics, news, sports, and people that are shaping Rutherford County. Now your host, Truman Jones.
Good morning, Rutherford County. It's the Greg Tucker Show. Everybody looks forward to that every other week. And I'm constantly hounded by people. When are you going to get Greg back on? And it's only every other Tuesday. So, guys, just hold your horses a little bit and he'll be on. And this part of his show is brought to you by Murfreesboro Automotive today. When you need a car repair and you want someone you can trust, Murfreesboro Automotive is that place. Chuck Haynes is a staff of certified technicians that can fix anything. From the simple oil change to major auto repair, Murfreesboro Automotive is the only place you need. Murfreesboro Automotive, turn off Broad between Chewy's and Chili's onto Ridgely Road. Good morning, Greg.
Good morning. Good morning.
I read your article in the paper Sunday, and it's one of the more fascinating stories. And, of course, we've related to it on the radio a number of times. But it's one of those stories that just keeps going on and on. And it's like the old Western lore that we hear for years and years. It gets better as we as it goes on. But the thing about it is your research is bringing it to light and to a reality that actually happens. What do they say? Sometimes truth is stranger than fiction, and this is one of those cases.
I think so. We're talking, of course, about, as far as we know, the only Rutherford County native to have the, I wouldn't call it a distinction, but he made the 10 most wanted FBI list. And it took him a few years to do it.
Well, if you're going to be successful, it takes a while sometimes.
have to work at it. And obviously the story of Spence Edwards is a tragedy. Mm-hmm. But as you know from our conversations before, I enjoy very much taking an old story and trying to go back and find what actually happened, what's legend, what's fiction, what were the real facts. And we got one more installment to go, and I'm going to try not to get ahead. We left him sentenced to die in the Georgia electric chair.
Right.
And but there's more to the story, obviously. But this last episode, one of, to me, the more interesting facts is how close they came to a lynching and the steps that were taken to avoid it. As you know very well, when a law enforcement officer goes down, the law enforcement community reacts very strongly.
Very emotionally.
Very strongly. And when one is so flagrant and, frankly, successful to some extent in evading capture and evading justice, as Spence Edwards was with his brother and their companions, I mean, we were having classic Bonnie and Clyde car chases and running gun battles, shooting back and forth. And Spence won most of those. Of course, he lost the last one, which is why he was captured. And when he was captured, he was so weak from loss of blood because he had been hit in the arm by a high-powered rifle shot at one point. But you had 75 to 80... rural county sheriff's deputies and other law enforcement people in the chase.
And that was in Georgia.
Yeah, down in Georgia, and not the border. It was deep Georgia. It was over on the east side, down about central Georgia. In fact, if you'd go due south out of Augusta, you'd get into that part of the country where he was. And we're talking about 1948, 49, down in that period. And when he was captured, a direct quote from the sheriff was, the posse, they called it a posse, was so inflamed that the sheriff whose jurisdiction it was in, the Burke County Sheriff, very quickly literally threw all four of them into patrol cars and tore out of there with them because he was concerned that they might not survive to have their day in court. And he didn't take them to a county jail. Apparently the county jails still at that time in Georgia, that part of the country, were questionable. And so he took them to the state penitentiary.
Wow.
And they were...
That's an unusual move.
Yeah, they were locked up at that time, maybe still today, Reidsville, Georgia, mm-hmm. is where the state penitentiary was. Interesting things that were going on at the same time, though, on a national level. The late 40s, pending in Congress, and this is the same time we had three parties. We had the Dixiecrats, Democrats, Republicans. It was a post-war, just gone through a severe depression. It was, even compared to today, an unstable time. Pending before Congress at that time was an anti-lynching legislation. Lynching, wow. Lynching has always been illegal. I mean, why would we have anti-lynching legislation? Well, the federal government, and we've seen it in other areas, when they become concerned, sometimes quite justly, sometimes politically, that the jurisdiction of the states is not adequate for addressing a problem. And in some cases, they're right. For instance, kidnapping, which can be an interstate thing.
Right.
They make it a federal crime, and that way federal authorities are involved, and you don't run into the jurisdictional issues state to state or different laws in different states. And you remember the kidnapping federal laws came after the Lindbergh kidnapping, which gripped the country and
it
tore
it. It always takes something like that to do it.
Well, something had happened, and there was anti-lynching bill pending in Congress at this same time that Spence was having his problems. And the activity in Congress was focusing on the southern states. In fact, it was one of those situations where they were going to specify certain states and put them on a different status with respect to the issue. Mm-hmm. We still have that in a couple of areas now. The governor of Georgia the next morning gets a detailed report on what's happened. I guess it's hard to tell that he was sincere, but he took immediately the attitude that these people are not at risk. We are not a violent state governed by mob actions. And he ordered that they get them out of the state penitentiary. He ordered that they take them straight back to the Emanuel County, which is where the crime had occurred. In fact, probably where the hot blood and resentment was at its peak.
Was that a political move?
Absolutely a political move. He even admitted that he wanted to show to the world, demonstrate to the world, it wasn't the United States or Congress, he said, I want the world to see that Georgia is not a violent place and that we are not ruled by mob violence and we are not afraid of such occurring. Mm-hmm. He even went so far as to order the sheriff of that particular county to come pick him up immediately and to bring only a limited number of his deputies, only the minimum number necessary to be sure they didn't escape.
I didn't know that fell in his jurisdiction.
Apparently when the governor issues a directive. And that's what happened. They picked him up immediately with just enough manpower to load them up and carry them back and put them in the county jail. And then
this was publicized.
Oh, yeah. And the governor even spoke to the people. And it was something like, knowing your sheriff and his colleagues in surrounding counties, knowing the family of the victim, and knowing the people of the county, I am confident there will be no risk, no fear of mob violence.
I'm sure there was... They even gave the route that he was coming back and when and everything.
Oh, yeah, specified, don't take him back, don't hide him, I want him to go down. You know, they were putting on a show for Congress primarily up in Washington that, you know, we don't have a problem here. Well, of course, when you go to that length to illustrate you don't have a problem, it's essentially a concession that we've got a problem down here and we're going to deal with it, though. They got him moved, but as I indicated in the article, the local jurisdiction, the local, did the next thing. They had him at trial within 3 or 4 weeks. He was still recovering from wounds. His attorneys, who I have to assume were court-appointed attorneys, his attorneys worked it pretty hard. They tried to get a delay so he could heal. they tried to move it out of that county on the usual, you know, you can't get a fair trial here. And they asked for a delay just to prepare because they hardly even knew the fella and certainly didn't know all the background at that time. The local court said, nope, we're going to try him literally in a few days.
Talk about a court laden with mistakes.
Yeah, yeah.
And you talk about tying the hands of attorneys before they ever get in there.
Oh,
it's
absolutely. They did decide that they'd try the four separately, and I think they really had spotted Spence. The evidence that I've seen, he was probably not or was not the trigger man. But they had spotted him as the ringleader and the one that had embarrassed the law enforcement communities from Tennessee, Georgia, Alabama, South Carolina, where he had been on his rampage. Not only did they bring him to trial quickly, but they found him competent to stand trial despite his wounds. And the whole trial was less than a day.
Wow.
The jury came in with its verdict that night, and the verdict left no room for discretion. The verdict, as it was the rule down in Georgia, found him guilty of first-degree murder with no recommendation for leniency or anything, which meant capital punishment. This is in April, and he was set to die in the electric chair on June 4th. And compared to today, which can get out of reason,
years, yeah.
But you know, we're talking 6 weeks, so that's why I say his attorneys—they were moving mountains.
Wonder how many witnesses were used 14. In a one-day trial.
The prosecution called 14 witnesses.
Wow.
Spence testified on his own behalf, and his cousin, the 16 to 18-year-old cousin, Evelyn Lacks, who had fled with them, apparently not for anything she had done, but just the adventure, the excitement. She testified on his behalf, and their stories were consistent.
But she was wounded also, wasn't she?
Yeah, she was hit in early fire, and just, we'd call it a flesh wound, but by the time... they were finally caught. You know, she had lost a lot of blood, too. The other two, Alfred, the older brother, and Spence's wife, weren't even injured unless they had problems with the environment in the swamp. And I think, and this, as we'll see in the next chapter, was one of his problems. He was not good at the outdoor survival. And I think the swamp as much is because they cornered them in an old farmhouse. They thought they had them surrounded, and he got all four of them out again, and they fled into the swamp. And since they were heavily armed, the posse decided not to pursue them on foot in the swamp and called in bloodhounds and airplanes, and it was the airplane that finally spotted one of four airplanes circling. The swamp itself, I think, had something to do with Spence deciding it was time to walk out. Because they did. They came out with their hands up. You know, there wasn't that last
That's a
fight.
Hard decision to make, isn't it? Because you know that you're going to be gone no matter what you do. So as great as he was as adapting to things, I would have never thought that he would have
Well, gone. He still had a survival instinct. He obviously wasn't suicidal because you are aware of situations where you're not going to take them alive. They want to die there.
It happens.
Yeah, and that wasn't the case. And I think, and I always have a tendency to get sympathetic with those that I spend some time studying. I think Spence was concerned about the others. And I remember the whole problem started because he wanted to get his brother out of jail.
He was an enigma, wasn't he?
He was.
He really was.
And as you've heard from one of your earlier guests down here, at times, he could be a very good friend, a very close friend.
Yeah.
Yeah, Jerry Warner commented on that. And I think if he had not had two women and his older brother with him, he might have had a different outcome there because he knew he was going to walk right into, if not a lynch mob, at least a rush to judgment. And that's exactly what happened.
He would almost be a real-life James Cagney. In some respects, you know, some of his old movies where he would come out in a blaze of gunfire at the end, that's what you would think from Spence Edwards.
Yeah. Unfortunately, no, because the rest of the story is also a good story, and he gives us another chapter.
It's so fun listening to you tell about not only Spence Edwards, but the time. I mean, we're talking about the late 1940s.
Oh, yeah.
And you don't think of that being so much different than today.
Picture the vehicles that were going to be involved in these car chases. And I'd love to have seen when he left right after the shooting and they took off, they were in a 47 Ford. And they go tearing up the highway and decide the Ford, since it had been recognized, was a risk. So they commandeered a Buick. And I have read some things that Buick was his favorite car. That was his car.
Yeah.
Anyway, they're tearing up the highway, and one patrol car is alerted to they're coming your way. So he parks his patrol car across the road as a block, you know. And I assume he got out and was standing off, you know, I'm going to take him, because the description in the paper was the patrol car was disabled by gunfire. I imagine they just emptied everything into that car and swerved around it and kept going.
And you didn't have the backup or the communications back then as they do now.
No, they had radios, but apparently it was, and were it not for the radios, they wouldn't have caught them. But, you know, they kept bringing in more, and the group chasing them kept growing.
We didn't bring up about what really set all this off. And you brought it up last time, just for people who didn't hear, there was a GBI agent that was actually killed.
Right.
I think they had been maybe at a restaurant or something. And he
I suspect you saw it when you read my account of it.
Right.
The GBI agent had been an agent for 3 weeks. Mm-hmm. And he acted, I would say, without good discretion. Mm. He was off duty.
And he was a new GBI agent.
Yeah, he had.
Yeah, so he had.
Yeah, he was inexperienced. He wasn't really young. He was in his mid-30s, but he was very green as an agent. And his background before that was not as a law enforcement officer. He'd actually been a flight instructor.
He was a little overzealous in what he was doing without the safety measure being in place.
He confronted him while he was off duty, and then he walks out, supposedly knowing that others are out there in the car. And the account of an eyewitness that I think is probably the most reliable and apparently was not used at the trial indicates rather clearly that Spence wasn't the trigger man. Uh-huh. That Alf, who was in my opinion, reading about him, and later we'll see, he was unstable. Mm-hmm. And the way it reads is, the way the eyewitness testimony plays, Alf lost his cool when he saw that his brother was being escorted back to the car and jumped out and started shooting. And at that particular instant, Spence apparently never fired until they were in their car making their run, their getaway. But the community wanted Spence, and so they targeted Spence.
Well, he was the name, and he's the one that everybody seemed to be after. He was the Billy the Kid or whatever.
Yeah,
but if you get down to the realities, if all the information that you've got is accurate, which I have no doubt that it is accurate, maybe the trial really didn't go the way it should have.
I think I'd have to agree with that.
Yeah.
A rush to judgment is just that.
Right.
And of course, having been a litigator for many years, if you approach a court now with a reasonable argument that you've not had opportunity to prepare in a capital punishment case, you get that opportunity. Now, the court knows what's fair opportunity. They're not going to let you just delay things, but they give you that opportunity because they know if the sentenced party can make a cogent argument that they didn't have adequate time to prepare a defense in a capital case, they'll get more time. You know, they'll have to come around and do it again. So,
but emotions took over everybody.
Yeah,
it really did. And you can imagine the groundswell of hate that was going on against Spence Edwards at that time.
That point about the fear of lynching,
Well, I guess we need to take a quick break.
All right.
Because we're getting to the part that we're heading toward right now.
All right.
And we'll be right back with Greg Tucker.
Looking for a really smart gift for your child or grandchild this holiday? Something that won't break or need batteries? Try the Tennessee Department of Treasury's new Tennessee Stars College Savings 529 program. If you open a Tennessee Stars account with at least $50 by December 31st, 2012, you get a one-time $50 match from the state. Roll over your entire balance from another college savings plan and receive $100 in your Tennessee Stars account. To learn about the Tennessee Stars College Savings 529 program, its investment objectives, risks, and costs, read the official statement available at www.tnstars.com or call toll-free 855-386-7827. Check with your home state to learn if it offers tax or other benefits for investing in its own 529 plan. Tennessee Stars is the holiday gift that keeps on giving for a lifetime. Visit www.tnstars.com or call toll-free 855-386-7827 and open your account today.
Tennessee Radio Network News, I'm Kristen Thoburn. The Memphis metro area is showing improvement in its economic performance and a partial economic recovery. A Brookings Institute report showed the area has outperformed the national average as far as gross domestic product per capita change through 2011 and 2012, but is lagging in employment change. The report ranks the Bluff City's economic performance at 133rd of the 300 largest metropolitan economies in the world. Job opportunities for veterans this morning.
Fort Campbell will host a job fair for veterans, military spouses, and wounded soldiers who are looking for new job opportunities outside the military. The job fair will be held on the post on the Tennessee-Kentucky state line today.
TRN's Dan Idem. Students at some schools in Tennessee and four other states will have at least 300 more hours of learning time in the calendar starting in 2013. The three-year pilot program is intended to boost student achievement and make U.S. schools more competitive. Tennessee Education Department spokeswoman Kelly Gothier says there isn't a list yet of which schools have applied. This is the time of year when Tennesseans are swamped with requests for end-of-year charitable donations. Joe Rosen with the American Cancer Society says if you're solicited by an unfamiliar charity, be sure to check it out first.
It's always good to go to their website, look them up on Charity Navigator, and actually call.
Rosen says reputable charities are more than happy to give you all the information you need to donate wisely.
Next is the Better Business Focus with Terry Page.
ProLift Systems is involved with all aspects of foundation repair. ProLift Systems 481-4735 has two decades of experience in residential and commercial construction and foundation repair in Murfreesboro and surrounding areas. ProLift Systems 481-4735. If you notice drywall cracks, doors and windows that are hard to open, cracks in mortar, or water in the crawl space, call ProLift Systems at 481-4735 for a free inspection and estimate.
Remember the saying, you can bank on it? They were trying to gain your trust. Customer trust is more important today than ever before. And businesses who are in tune with the needs of their customers understand the right balance between high-tech and high-touch services. Meeting customer expectations and doing it with respect is the ultimate test of better business. This is Terry Page with your local Better Business Bureau.
Gleason asked to be taken to a mental hospital, was shot and killed by a Jefferson County Sheriff's deputy. They say the 41-year-old unidentified man charged at deputies with a weapon in each hand. One refinery worker is dead after being exposed to a hazardous substance at the Valero refinery yesterday. He's one of two workers who were injured in yesterday's hazmat incident. I'm Kristen Thoburn, Tennessee Radio Network News.
Don't know what to get that hunter or fisherman on your Christmas list? You need to stop by Murfreesboro Outdoors on Northwest Broad.
Everybody we've got here hunts and fishes. We're not just a store that don't know what we're doing. Everybody here knows what's going on.
That's Randy Bolin at Murfreesboro Outdoors.
We got clothing, camouflage from top to bottom. Shotguns, shells, boots, pretty much anything. We got it.
Remember Murfreesboro Outdoors for that hunter or fisherman on your Christmas list.
We're located at 2204 Northwest Broad Street, right in front of International Pipeline. paper.
Jay Cash, the auctioneer and real estate broker, is conducting a court-ordered estate auction Saturday, December 8th at 10 a.m. Located at 1911 Pacific Place, right off Highway 99, the New Salem Highway in Murfreesboro, is a single-family, three-bedroom, two-bath home with 1,460 square feet. The home also features a two-car garage and fenced backyard. Excellent location, just moments from I-24. A great investment opportunity. Visit jamesrcash.net for more details. The auction is Saturday, December 8th at 10 a.m. Auction being conducted by James R. Cash Auctions from 5802.
WeatherEye.
For the forecast area, showers likely, few rumbles of thunder later on, highs in the upper 60s, we'll have a south-southwest wind between 10 and 15. I'm WGNS staff meteorologist Mandy Thaluber.
Right now, 63.
Our good neighbor of the day is Tanya Miller. She receives flowers from Ryan's Flowers and Gifts. Our birthday cake winner, Jason Hayes, receiving the birthday cake from Junior's Foodland. You had an accident and the guy's bloodthirsty lawyer wants to sue you. How would you protect yourself? Affordable liability insurance from Safe Auto. For not a lot of money, you can protect yourself from your own mistakes. Call 1-800-SAFE-AUTO now. Drive safe, spend less, Safe Auto.
He knows Rutherford County, and he knows the people of Rutherford County. Truman Jones, here on WGNS, AM and FM.
And welcome back with the Greg Tucker Show. This part is brought to you by At Home Care. When you and your family members need assistance for a day, a week, or indefinitely, At Home Care is ready to sit down with you and help devise a practical plan to meet your family's needs. At Home Care, it's different than any others you see in the local marketplace because they're owned and operated by longtime Murfreesboro resident Melissa Warren. That means that Home Care is hands-on, involved in your family members' care and satisfaction all day, every day. At Home Care provides top-quality professional caregiving services throughout Rutherford County and Middle Tennessee. Whether you need a 24/7 companion, ongoing assistance with transportation to church or doctor's appointments, laundry, housekeeping, personal care, or more, At Home Care is here for you. At Home Care, 713-4639, online at homecaretennessee.com. That's 713-4639. Well, poor old Spence has been sentenced. And
right now it's out of his hands.
Yeah.
But fortunately the system was there and there were others working on his behalf. We'll see how that works out. A clue, though, a life like that rarely has a happy ending.
Yeah.
So that's the way it was going. But the governor's involvement, and not truly on behalf of the accused at all, he was looking out for the reputation of his state and the perception, prompted me to go back and take a look at the... Rutherford has, I think, a fascinating history, and a history we can be proud of. It has its dark moments, though.
Right.
And as many outstanding people who have done so much for the community and for the nation as a whole in many cases, as we've illustrated several times, there were those who put us in a bad light, at least for a time. And there are in documented history 9 lynchings in Rutherford County.
That's amazing.
Yeah, and I say documented because the earliest documented was in 1869, and these are all after the Civil War when things like that began to be documented. So there's no way of focusing on the period before the Civil War, but after the Civil War. And the earliest ones, you can't find any identification, just kind of vague references to 2 prisoners, you know, who didn't make it to trial. But beginning in the 1870s, there were 4 lynchings, perhaps and 1 in the 90s. But in 1908, which brings us up to the last century, the 20th century, a crime involving a murder had 3 men in jail, and a crowd characterized in the paper as a mob, but it was at least 50 men on horseback rode up to the jail, and you have to have sympathy with the jailer. You know, give us who we want or we'll walk over you. We're going to ride over you. And they took 3 out of the jail. And one of them managed to escaped somehow. And I think the suggestion in the paper was he actually had some friends involved, and he escaped. But in July, August of 1908, there was this lynching with this mob, and it made the New York Times, headline New York Times, lynchings in Murfreesboro, Tennessee. So clearly
that's something you don't ever figure.
Yeah. And as is the case in virtually every lynching that there's any documentation of anywhere, those responsible are seldom, if ever, brought to justice. And that's part of the definition of a mob. You know, how do you finger someone in there? Today, the mob would be tried. Probably, anybody that could be identified. But in those days, since no one would talk, and, you know, the only perception was that it was a mob, a crowd, you know, they were rarely ever prosecuted.
If a person's conscience does not come forward, it's almost impossible to prosecute.
Mm-hmm.
It really did. In fact, there have been known, there is a city, and I'm thinking it was in Missouri, where a guy was just running roughshod over everybody, just a town bully, just destroying people's lives. And one day the town rose up against him and killed him.
Mm-hmm.
And the family came in, wanted them prosecuted, and the FBI came in and could not get one person to give any evidence at all of what happened. So, and that hasn't been, you know, maybe 30, 40 years ago.
Well, I guess there can be, Truman, several different things going on. Yeah. One is sympathy with what happened.
Right.
You know, so they're not going to put anybody at jeopardy or risk because the community is at sympathy with what happened. That's a sad circumstance. The other is fear. And I think that's frequently the case, even today, particularly in large urban areas where, you know, people are so close together. And you know, you're fearful that you'll be the next target if you're not, don't keep your mouth shut, if you say anything.
I have seen that. People in vulnerable positions, if they don't feel confident with whatever safety you can provide,
mm-hmm.
They've got to protect themselves.
Well, a prosecutor, I think, and even in my civil work, there were times when I knew somebody knew something, and I knew somebody, if they would testify, would serve the cause I was representing. But you appreciate that their circumstances are such that they just can't come forward. Mm-hmm. And you can try to force them, but if you do, you're not going to get what you're looking for. So I've had situations where we had to pass on particular testimony because we knew. And sometimes it's just, you know, I've got a family to feed and I can't put my job at risk.
Mm-hmm.
Other times it can be much more dangerous than that, but that does happen.
That's one of the biggest obstacles that law enforcement has, is intimidation. And when that comes to the forefront, and I mean, you can't get in somebody else's mind when that fear takes
right,
hold of them.
Right.
It is tough.
And again, you'd know more about this than I do, but when the law enforcement or the prosecutors promise protection, how credible is that? You know, yes, maybe for months, a year, but are you going to be here 5 years from now? You know, the threat may be, you know, such that it's hard to get beyond it.
I think the FBI maybe, and I don't know if they're the ones that came up, but I think one of the best things that they've done over the years as far as prosecuting large groups, whether it be gangs or whatever, is they allow them to change their identity and set them up in other places.
Mm-hmm.
But even when you get into that, you've got bad guys that are against bad guys in those type situations, and that's a hard thing to deal with when you're in law enforcement and you're trying to figure out what is the worst scenario that we've got here and how we're going to deal with it. It really is. It's tough.
Mm. Mm.
Now, you have got a list, and it's a very interesting list, because I know a lot of these people, or I know a lot of their families.
Well,
and it's the bad and not so bad characters from Rutherford County.
Yeah, that's right. Last time we were together, we were talking on the other side of it. Those who some have been forgotten, but who made real significant contribution. Last night, I just thought I'd take a crack at a list of those that we've talked about, we've written about, that I'd put on the other side, and I emphasize the not so bad. because some of them at the time were perhaps consistent with the culture. And others are, to me, colorful characters who made their living a little different from the rest of us. But guys you wouldn't mind sitting down and having a drink with. And then there are some that are really scary. Just a few, but some that are really scary.
I've known a number of these people, and I've known a number of their reputations. And I can tell you, they're enjoyable to be with, a lot of them.
Well, when you get into the group that I would call our men of chance, our gamblers and our bootleggers and such. The bootleggers in particular, they were contributing to the economy. I remember talking to a teetotaler out of Burke's Hollow who wouldn't even have a bottle of anything in his house. But his neighbor up in the Hollow, who he was good friends with and took up for, was producing and storing and trafficking. This is back some years ago, of course. And I remember my friend, my mentor, it was Quilla Boma, and he said, you know, Quilla says, well, you know, speaking of his neighbor, he said he brought a lot of money into the Hollow back in the years when there just wasn't much. And
Quilla Bowman was one of the more interesting, nicest people. He was on the county commission for a number of years.
Yeah, and school board for a number of years.
And really had a common sense way of looking at everything.
Oh, if he finished the eighth grade, he didn't brag about it, but he may have finished the eighth grade. But when it came to worldly knowledge and how to get things done and how to judge character, he was impressive. And he kind of took me under his wing when we returned to the area because I was taking up farming, and he knew immediately I didn't know what I was doing. And he used to come over almost daily and talk to me, work with me and such. But he was very clear, and I think it's the first time I had really kind of focused on and thought about it, that these people, law violators, in fact, this particular one, spent time in prison, came back out, went right back to work. They made a significant difference in the economy during those rough years, the 30s, the 40s, up in some of the Hollows around here. So I got a handful of names that would fall into that group, and I would certainly call them not so bad characters. Mm-hmm.
Actually, they were kind of products of the way of life that had been passed down from generation to generation, a lot of them.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And, you know, they observed that that was the way the father made the living. And, you know, they were all also farming. But even then, I guess, farmers have to have a real job somewhere.
Go ahead.
The two on the list that really offend me, I'm glad to be able to say they were not from around here. Mm-hmm. They came in. And one of them is C.B., and his name is ironic, Highmark, because I say he was clearly a low mark in the medical profession. Mm-hmm. He was a doctor. He's the doctor that came into Eagleville. And he had the credentials to be a doctor and was embraced very quickly by a community that was starved for medical care and such at the time. We're talking the turn of the century, 1890s, 1900s. Mm-hmm. But he was dealing in cadavers. He was a grave robber. Mm-hmm. Of course, he hired a couple of young fellows to do the digging. But then
Igor, and who was the other one?
Igor was one of them, I'm sure. Well, that was his downfall. His mm-hmm. two young fellas eventually identified him as, you know, because they got caught doing the digging and they turned in. If we had had the forensic sciences that are common today and have been for probably 50 years, he was more than robbing graves. He was putting people in the graves. Mm. You read again about ministering to someone who seemed to be suffering from what we might today identify as the flu. But the symptoms aren't apparently life-threatening, and the next morning they're dead.
He wasn't doing scientific experiments, was he?
He wasn't doing scientific. He was packing them up in boxes, marking the boxes books, and shipping them to the Northeast.
That's amazing.
And he got away with it for a couple of years until finally, and even though the community began to be concerned, and, you know, just suspicious, it wasn't until someone discovered a grave just recently opened and caught up with the two young men that were doing the digging. A further irony, he was essentially caught red-handed. He was tried and got a slap on the wrist. Medical profession protected him. And as I say, there was no forensic hard evidence of him doing anything except shipping bodies. And he got a light sentence, and after spending some time, but we're talking months, not years, he relocated up in the Wisconsin, Minnesota area, and tracking him on the census reports, he ended up as a coroner, a convenient position for his business up there. CB Highmark, though, we know he came in from somewhere else and he left. The other one that I would put in a similar category is Carolyn Martin. The name is not familiar, but she was the eldest of the Wardlaw, mm-hmm. and that is a prominent name throughout much of the South. Very wealthy, prominent family in Mississippi. The two younger Wardlaw sisters came up and took over Soule College, eventually bought the college. And Soule College before and during their early years was, you know, one of the proud gemstones of the community. And after they were established and purchased literally the college and the property, which was over here on Maple Street, the mother moved in with them, and they used the top floor of a three-story building, long since gone. It was on the property that later became the high school, later became Middle Tennessee Electric, now is the Murfreesboro Housing Authority. She showed up and moved into the top floor. Well, she brought her business with her. And you wonder why the two who were doing such an outstanding job running the school would acquiesce to her coming in. The most prominent, Elizabeth Wardlaw, who had a sterling reputation across the South as a headmistress of a girls' finishing school, had a dark secret. She had had a child out of wedlock, and to conceal it, Carolyn, who was married at the time to an old veteran named Martin, she took the child and made it out as though it was her own and raised it. Raised a beautiful young woman who came down here with her when she moved down here. So she had a grip on the family, you know, and I don't know whether she brought it up literally, but you can sense that there was an awareness that Carolyn knows the secret, and the name of the family and the reputation of the family was such that no one wanted to risk, you know, exposing what then would have devastated the reputation of Elizabeth and probably put her out of ever, you know, being a lead headmistress of a women's finishing school. So Carolyn comes down here after having done away with her husband and collected his insurance, and she brought her daughter, and her daughter was her, I don't know what would you say, her 401k, her pension, because the daughter had been named as the heiress to the Colonel Martin's assets. Mm-hmm. He had passed over his wife and had left them to whom he had treated as though it was his real daughter. But anyway, her business beyond insurance fraud was taking and selling babies that were the result of unwanted, unplanned pregnancies. And this was going on back in those days just as it does today, only back then it was always something the family wanted to conceal. And Carolyn had developed a business of taking payment from the family or from the young woman to take the baby and convince the mother, the family, that she would place it in a good home. Well, she defined a good home as the best price, and she was selling the infants. And if for some reason the infant didn't survive or was unsaleable, eventually the infant would die. And, you know, they would dispose of the body. It was interesting that one part of the Murfreesboro community was quite aware of what was going on, and this is the servant over in the Bottoms. Mm-hmm. because they worked as the janitors and such at the school and were aware of what was going on. And the same, you know, the information had traveled through there. She had even used some of the people out of that community to do the burials, to dispose of bodies if couldn't otherwise. Payment was frequently made in jewelry, cash not being available, that kind of thing. And she had a little sack full of jewels that turned up later over at one of the banks in a lockbox that she hadn't been able to sell. But the domestic working class in the Bottoms and over in Mink Slat also worked on Main Street and Maney and the better parts of town. So the information had filtered around. But the proper part of Murfreesboro would not acknowledge, would not admit to themselves or anybody else what was going on. So no effort was made to stop it until finally... More because of the insurance fraud activity and their inability or unwillingness to pay the debts. They put the school into a deep, deep debt. And the activity had scared away a lot of the girls in the families. So there are stories of Carolyn coming down out of the upstairs area where she lived and walking through a classroom and scaring, you know, just from her appearance. She was strange, obviously, probably crazy. She wore black all the time, veiled her face as a widow, which she was.
What would have been the place for a, say, a local newspaper? You know, local newspapers hear everything. But it's so interesting that did they have the same attitude as the rest of the hierarchy in the community?
When things got too hot and too heavy, primarily because of the debts, all the Wardlaws, Ms. Martin, the mother, all of them hit the train about 1908 in the dark of night and disappeared. Later turned up doing the same thing over in Virginia, but they disappeared. Now, what on your point, 20 years later, the fellow who was the editor and owner of the newspaper during that period wrote a book, C.C. Henderson. And it's the first focused history of Murfreesboro, and it's called The Story of Murfreesboro. He says in the preface, this is neither fact nor fiction, but this is the story as I know it. He came to that point and whitewashed it just incredibly and just denied that all of the rumors. Because, see, by that time there had been a trial, and Carolyn Martin and her sister had been tried for murder up in New Jersey. And 20 years later, we're still in denial down here, and the fellow writing the story at the time was the newspaper editor during the period. Now, do you think he knew what was going on?
That's amazing. We're going to take a quick break. This gets more interesting as it goes along. We'll be right back with Greg Tucker.
Hi, I'm Dr. Britt Miaton, a cardiologist with St. Thomas Heart at Middle Tennessee Medical Center. Did you know that St. Thomas Heart is Middle Tennessee's number one rated heart program? At MTMC, we offer comprehensive services for the treatment and prevention of heart disease. From early diagnosis to minimally invasive surgical procedures, St. Thomas Heart at MTMC offers you heart care close to home. For information, visit heartasone.com or call 867-5028.
The Outpost Armory is not just another gun store. Our staff has hands-on knowledge and experience with firearms, self-defense training, hunting, and competitive shooting. We cater to the new gun owner and the expert looking for that hard-to-find product. We carry items that the big chain stores don't and have bulk ammunition for the high-volume shooter. We defend the Second Amendment and help responsible citizens protect their families, rights, and liberties. Visit us in person or online at theoutpostarmory.com. The Outpost Armory, I-24 East at Exit 89 in Murfreesboro.
Southern Community Bank, unlike all the rest. Beverly Barker, branch manager.
Southern Community Bank is a strong, independent community partner with a simple philosophy. Keep banking hassle-free for people who just want to be treated well.
We're unlike all the rest. Our services are intuitive. Our team is friendly. Our approach is refreshing. And our service is clearly unique.
We're located at 1950 Old Fort Parkway, next to the DoubleTree Hotel.
Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
Let Jeff Sowell's Family Restaurant prepare your deep-fried or smoked turkey for Christmas. 867-2164. Complete meals are prepared and ready for pickup when you need it. 867-2164.
It's time. Blue Raiders.
Support your Blue Raiders as they compete for back-to-back Sun Belt Conference titles. Men's and women's basketball combo season tickets are on sale now and start as low as $199. Don't miss a single three-pointer. Score a slam dunk with season tickets today.
Show your true blue. Support your Blue Raiders. Tickets available at GoBlueRaiders.com or call 1-888-YES-MTSU. Go Blue Raiders.
He knows Rutherford County's past, and his wisdom can give good insight into our future. It's the Truman Show. Here again, Truman Jones.
And welcome back with Greg Tucker. And, you know, history is so much fun and so interesting because of all the characters, and you bring up all their emotions and everything that attributes to their particular character. And when you start thinking of people that are the ones that are supposed to be the light bearers, you might say the information people, like a newspaper was very powerful back then. And if the newspaper refuses to go along with the the truth, you might say, you've got a real problem in your community.
And newspapers then more than now, because now there's so many alternate sources. Right. But if a newspaper
had... Thank goodness we have radio now.
If a newspaper or any media, and particularly back years ago, they always had an interest or a bias. You know, sometimes, for instance, during the Civil War, there were two newspapers, very prominent, active newspapers in Murfreesboro. One was Union sympathetic, and the other was clearly on the other side. Yeah. And I give Rosecrans some credit. He let both of them publish.
But that would be highly unusual.
Yeah, Rosecrans, although he was our occupying general down here, we were fortunate. He was a humane. He didn't hesitate to execute the traitors, right. Not the traitors, the deserters.
Right.
His predecessor, General Crittenden, on my list of...
In fact, he was right at the top.
bad characters, because he came in here with the attitude that all the people down here were traitors, and traitors were shot back then, and or hung, and he had a whole bunch of them hitting that direction. Rosecrans came down with more of an attitude that we were the occupied, and... assuming that we weren't actively spying or resisting or fighting, you know, he showed some respect for the community. Newspapers frequently have a political interest, and depending on who's there and whose political side they're on, that can bias and influence coverage quite a bit. Economic interests are also a very heavy influence on newspapers of the past. I think still, you know, you got to be viable. You got to be financially viable. Yeah. And some stories threaten that viability.
And you have to have conflicting views a lot of times to make both of them survive. I mean, they both can't be pro-Democrat or pro-Republican or however you want to look at liberal and conservative.
Spending time in Nashville back in the 60s and 70s when we had two newspapers, both very financially viable,
yes,
and very much run by personalities that are part of the community. In the political right, you knew everything about both sides.
Oh,
because
books have been written about that time.
Oh, yeah, that was...
And I can't wait for your book to come out. Of course, I know you're not telling anybody, and you're probably telling me that you're not going to do it, but I know that you're going to do a novel on Spence Edwards, and it's going to be one of the more interesting books. I can't wait for you to dig in and get it going, because it's one of those books you won't be able to put down.
Well, the next book is going to once again be Rutherford,
right.
And I'm hoping to spend some real time on it over the next couple of months, so next spring we'll have another book out.
And next time, it's Tuesday week, I want to get into these famous and infamous characters that you've got. I mean, the Hall of Fame or the Hall of Shame, however you want to call it.
And let's tell our readers, I very much appreciate you loaning me your glasses this morning.
And we're both blind.
I forgot my reading glasses, and you had an extra pair. And would have worked fine, except they were so greasy they kept slipping off my face.
Well, yeah,
thanks anyway.
You're exactly right. They are, and they fall off every time. Tomorrow, you know, we're talking about the famous doctor or the infamous doctor from Eagleville. And but we have the other side. We have Dr. Dan Rudd, who is, I feel like, is the chairman of the board when it comes to class and honesty.
And he has a strong connection to the law enforcement community.
He has a very strong connection. And he and I were actually got to go see Dr. Ruland last
Well, I remember having we had lunch with Dr. Yes. Ruland and Dr. Rudd not too long ago.
And since we're talking about people in the news, I do want to mention that next Monday at 9 o'clock we're going to have Hudley Crockett on the show, and that is going to be a super show.
Broadcaster, yeah, and a bit of a politician,
yeah, just a little bit. And see you guys in the morning at 9 o'clock.